What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
On today's show, cleaning up white supremacy sounds odd, yes, but some white supremacists are pushing wellness and health while continuing to peddle their hate. Joining us to discuss is Mark Hay, a freelance journalist based in New York. He covers conspiracism and far-right movements, among other topics. His recent article in Al Jazeera that we are discussing today is Soap to Supremacy, The Rise of White Wellness. First of all, Mark, thank you for coming on the show. Second of all, and we're going to go, there's so much detail in this article and so many different characters and layers to why this actually matters and folks to pay attention. How did this come onto your radar, this phenomena, I guess, that white supremacists are infiltrating the health and wellness space, which is, you know, on and popping right now?
Sure. I've been looking into, well, I guess we have to jump backwards pretty far. I've been cursorily aware of the white supremacist movement, the white nationalist movement in America since I was a child, because I grew up in the inland Northwest, so the physical compound of the Aryan Nations was a physical presence in my childhood. So that was something I was very aware of. When I got into reporting as an adult, I was very aware of conspiracy theories, very aware of extremist groups in America, kind of frustrated by some of the coverage that I saw of them and wanted to dig into elements of them that I didn't see covered as often. That said, I did not have any idea about the wellness angle at first. When I started looking into some of these groups circa 2018, 2019, then I found myself just sitting in some of these social media forums, some of these chat groups where people really go off pretty candidly about their beliefs. And I started seeing ads for soap and cooking classes. And, you know, you're just sitting there and you're thinking, what? Okay, sure. And I think it was one of them had some pretty clearly racist joke coded names, things that I was recognizing not as explicit, but they were references to some pretty grim far-right memes, some pretty grim dog whistles in the soap names. So I thought, okay, I got to look into that. I did one very small piece just on that company for the Daily Beast back in, I think it was 2021. But when I finished that up, I had found all of these other little companies and ventures. And so I approached an editor at Al Jazeera and said, hey, I kind of found something here. You want to talk about it? And that turned into this.
All right. Well, let's get into it. Let's start how you start. Let's start with Kyle Hunt. Who is he?
Sure. Kyle Hunt is an individual who I tried to speak to directly for this piece. I called him and he hung up on me, which is kind of par for the course. You know, you are seen as enemy media when you are in a mainstream publication. Kyle Hunt is a guy originally from Cape Cod out in Massachusetts. Grows up a pretty standard, well-off, not super well-off, but moderate, standard American life, goes to college, goes into the tech industry, but starts to get interested in alternative, I guess what we'd now call alternative facts. And through that somehow gets to explicit anti-Semitism. That's not very debatable. He makes a radio station, a digital radio station, makes a digital publication where he's just spreading outright anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, spreading race hate of various kinds, talking about how he believes that America is systemically disadvantaging white men above all others. And at some point, he decides that since he is relatively unemployable, by being out and open in his opinions under his own name, trying to organize a white men's march across America in 2014, that he starts to do odd jobs, he starts to do menial labor, but he also gets involved in some wellness ventures. And a couple of years ago, he starts his own sort of digital apothecary as a means of supporting himself, but also as a means of conveying, per some of his own writings about it, some of his ideals about what the world should look like.
And he's not, Kyle is not a solo show. There are other white nationalists engaging in similar activities, running similar businesses. You were talking about names that alluded to things, ideologies of this ilk of folks. Talk about the Mighty White Soap Company.
Yes, Mighty White Soap Company was the first one that came on my radar. You know, Kyle Hunt is somebody who's kind of well known within the white nationalist world, so he's a good person to open on. But Mighty White Soap Company came onto my radar because this is a company that seems to be run out of somebody's house in the Midwest, making, you know, soap by hand in buckets in the backyard, but selling at a pretty good volume, it seems, with a lot of very clearly racially coded, racist coded soap names. Well, we're talking, you know, a body scrub called Caucasian Abrasion. Some of them, you know, some of these, some names that I don't necessarily repeat on the radio, but, you know, things like there was a bar, I think, called like Honky Kong or something like that. Things that allude to far right memes. And that allude to racist memes.
I mean, it's funny, and it's also it's terrifying. And part of why it's scary is, I think, what I said to my producer when he brought it up is that, and they're aware of this, and we'll get into how aware they are later, is that people often dismiss, right, these folks as like backwards country hick folks, no college education, you know, and therefore not a real threat. But that's not necessarily true. Right. These are folks that do go to colleges and start businesses that are in our communities, just they're in our communities on the un. And as they're there presenting as, I don't like the word normal, but presenting, you know, like they're not hate filled human beings. That's a way for them to like spread their message, right, inside of these normal conditions.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is one thing we bring up in the piece is that white nationalists, or really any flavor of hate group, they're very aware of how you or anyone else in America sees them. They're very aware that they don't want to be perceived in that way. They would like to be perceived as mainstream, as well-to-do, as family-friendly, as respectable. Having your own business is one way to do that. Starting political groups that have plausible deniability is one way to do that. And what we wanted to communicate with the piece was that while wellness isn't necessarily the only vector or the only avenue to do that, connecting yourself to this idea of wellness, which is, you know, it's a good, it's not a bad thing. That's not the point of the piece to say wellness is dangerous. No, it's a good to pursue wellness for yourself, your community, those around you, connecting yourself to that goal and then connecting your ideology to that goal and saying, hey, pro-white, quote-unquote, activism, white nationalist activism, the pursuit of a white resurgence or renaissance in America, that can be wellness too. That's a form of wellness for your white community.
I think the other thing, and I want to go back to soap before we move on to other wellness industries. I think the other thing that I thought about here pretty early on in the reading, right, is fundraising for the things that those kinds of groups fundraise for, right, to buy land, to buy firearms, to train, et cetera, that these are legitimate businesses, you know, as opposed to selling drugs or running guns or whatever, that they can funnel into their movement to stock up on, you know, whatever, their arsenals of things that they need for when the race war hits.
Yeah, I may be getting some facts wrong here because I'm just off the top of my dome, but I mentioned the Aryan Nations compound a while back. That's one of those very old school hate groups in America that, if I remember correctly, part of its downfall was that it was involved in gun running. I think there was a case involving the trafficking of sawed-off shotguns. I may be incorrect about that. I would need to go and check the record. But that clearly did not work very well for these people. It's not a good way to sustain a group to be involved in an illegal enterprise that will bring scrutiny to you. When your hate speech or when your racism is technically legal under the First Amendment, nobody can stop you from doing that. Why get yourself on law enforcement's radar by doing something illicit when you could fund yourself, your family, your community doing something legitimate? And a lot of people in hate movements do. They're, you know, all around us at all times, just living their lives and funding their movements through little ties to their community groups. But hey, if you can make a business that directly funnels into your activism and reflects your activism, for some of these people, all the better.
All right, one more soap person, and then we'll move on. William Jeffrey Poole, who is he, and why was the U.S. Army investigating him at one point?
So William Jeffrey Poole, as far as we could tell, because this is another individual who, when I tried to reach out directly, did not respond to me, but, you know, took my email and posted it up on a bunch of these platforms. And sort of mocked us, you know, thanked us for the business we were going to generate for him by publishing the name of the company. As far as we are aware, William Jeffrey Poole is an individual who's actually been written about before because his ex-wife has written about him. His ex-wife wrote about his journey from being a relatively standard young man joining the military to becoming a little more radical, a little more questionable, until she is called in towards the end of her own book on this. She is called in to testify in an investigation into his alleged posting of hate rhetoric on social media forums while serving in the Army Reserve.
And what of, and then, so then what happens? So there's this investigation, then what happens? What happens to Poole?
Well, what I can tell you, you know, the U.S. military does not necessarily release all details of these things.
No.
The investigation recommends a disciplinary action. That disciplinary action does not take place immediately, but he is separated from the military at some point. And after the investigation begins, but before he leaves service, he incorporates a soap company called Dissident.
You all are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. We are in conversation with Mark Hay, who has an article in Al Jazeera called Soap to Supremacy, The Rise of White Wellness. In your list of companies at the end, you mentioned two women who've set up this company called Clean and Pure. But I'm going to use that, we don't have to talk about them, but they were both members of the Patriotic Alternative. You could talk about what that group is in a second. But I'm interested, well, actually talk about what that is now. And then I'm interested just broadly about how women are treated inside of the white supremacist movement.
Sure. So Patriotic Alternative was created in, I believe, 2019, if I have that right off the top of my head, as a new far-right group in the UK that would project a family-friendly, nature-focused, community-focused image of what they call British nationalism. Now, British nationalism translates into the idea of Britain is for Britons. That means, to most members of the Patriotic Alternative, white Britons, people of different backgrounds, should be kindly invited to forcefully encouraged to leave the country so that the country can be returned to what they refer to as the indigenous people of the Isles. There's a lot of that effort to co-opt traditionally left-wing language about topics like indigeneity and bring it back towards white communities to code themselves as a progressive or good cause. So Patriotic Alternative starts up, and one of the things that they advocate for is, hey, we need to be able to speak freely our ideas, and one way that we can do that is to insulate ourselves from backlash from employers, from backlash from the government. So we encourage people to start their own ventures, start their own businesses. Small businesses are great because they help to insulate us from backlash and from the world that we have issues with. One of the companies through Patriotic Alternative, founded by one of their deputies, was actually created directly because this deputy tweeted at Yorkshire Tea during the BLM activism in 2020 and said, hey, you know, I appreciate that this brand doesn't actively support BLM. They came back to her and said, we do, educate yourself and don't buy our tea until you have. So she decided to found her own tea company instead.
Right on. Okay, part two of that question is, women in this movement have historically been relegated to what?
Yeah, there is one woman who was surprisingly candid about this in a podcast interview that I dug up. I think it was called, well, I don't want to promote the podcast, so I won't name the name. But she was pretty explicit with the far right host that she was talking to about the fact that when she got into the movement, they basically wanted to handcuff her to a radiator and make her a baby producing machine. Because in a lot of far right rhetoric, there is a focus on women as sacred, but sacred in so much as, to paraphrase one white nationalist who I read quite a bit of, because they make white babies, that makes them especially valuable and especially sacred. So there's this idea in some far right groups of women as just incubators of white nationalism, protectors of the white family, but not as political actors in and of themselves. There are exceptions to that over the years. There are some women who, you know, became very powerful within the movement or very active, but more often than not, they have historically been relegated to the homemaker role. And if they got too powerful, well, they would be purged.
Purged and chastised. I mean, can you talk about the backlash that some of these women face? Even some of these women that are creating businesses that in theory serve the movement.
Yeah, not many have historically tried to start businesses, but say when Twitter started to become a big thing, some tried to become influencers. And those who became too vocal, too active as political actors within the scene, who were seen as not just replicating or promoting their husband's activism, but having their own thoughts, were slammed down as, insert derogatory term for woman here, because I've seen quite a few used in this context, and basically told to shut up and go back to the kitchen.
I'm wondering about, I guess, I don't know how to say this. I'm wondering though, if this is also a recruitment tool possibly for other women, that they could recruit them into this type of business. It looks so benign, and help grow their ranks that way.
You really, really, really hope that it's not as easy as saying, shiny, happy image of a healthy family. By the way, neo-Nazism, oh, okay, some random woman's going to get on board with that. You really hope it's not that easy. But there is a pathway here. One, a pathway where people who are already kind of in or adjacent to the movement through wellness, which is often construed as a more domestic concern, see a legitimate way for themselves to get involved, to get very active in a public-facing form, a wellness venture or a wellness community or wellness activism without facing that backlash. And two, you see a way for these groups, these entities, these businesses to mimic the language of mainstream wellness and use that to subtly slide into mainstream wellness conversations and start to promote their own products and ideas very slowly. So it's not just wellness, neo-Nazism, hurrah, it's slow, slow, slow walk until you might have some racist ideas that you don't even recognize in the back of your head. You know, that thing of, hey, weren't the BLM movement protests uncomfortable for me? Don't I feel threatened in some way, shape, or form? Are we not under attack as white people? I'm being affirmed in that belief. I'm being told that that belief is tied to this mainstream wellness. Maybe I'll foster that idea a little bit more within myself now that it's being affirmed in a space that seems safe.
You know what I think is so interesting, and I know I'm bouncing to topics that aren't necessarily in the article. I find it so interesting that they talk so much, white supremacists, I mean, in general, about whole healthy families. But when you do backgrounds on these folks, like one of the biggest recruiting tools for these folks is that they weren't treated well by their families, right? That they come from homes where there's drug addiction, alcohol abuse, et cetera. And so create the same. I just find that a really interesting thread with these folks.
Yeah, this is where we would, you know, drift into armchair psychology, and I never want to assume anything, but it is, people are building a romanticized vision of the past more often than not. A lot of these movements look backwards to some sort of idea of what the ideal traditional family was, what it could be, what it should be. When do I think that America was truly great? What did that look like? What was the family like then? And they beat backwards towards that.
In your article, you mentioned a couple of folks that found their way out of the movement that were you know, in it. We actually interviewed one of the folks from Life After Hate. And they've shifted, but there's also some women that were pushed out of the movement. And I'm wondering, in your work or even in the conversations you have with this article, when people are driven out of the movement, does that necessarily mean that their viewpoints change, or are they just being hateful white folks somewhere else?
That's tricky. It's tricky in so much as some people do leave the movement just because they've been actively forced out. They've been purged out of their group, disillusioned, and that might challenge some of their views about, oh, was this community all I thought it was cracked up to be? But it often doesn't change, you know, something very fundamental in their heart or in their head. The people you spoke to with Life After Hate can probably speak to this a little more articulately than I can, but in my interactions with these people, you know, they'll often say that leaving the movement is one thing, acknowledging and actively denouncing the movement is another thing, and then doing the work of unpacking what led you there in the first place and what you might still be holding on to is a whole third lifelong thing.
Yeah, I mean, even progressive white folks, right, that consider themselves accomplices, they talk about that every day, that they have to get up and dismantle, you know, the colonization or the white supremacists, not in the same violent way that we're talking about here, but the way in which the white supremacy is ingrained into our culture out of themselves. So for these men and women, I imagine it's even more intense. You are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. On today's show, we're talking about cleaning up white supremacy with Mark Hay, whose article in Al Jazeera that we are discussing this morning is Soap to Supremacy, the Rise of White Wellness. All right, let's move on. What else is in the white wellness ecosystem? What other types of products, et cetera, are we seeing people sell?
Oh, literally anything that you can think of at a wellness store, they will make. And part of that is because a lot of wellness products, well, one of the reasons that industry is such a great, big, successful industry is you can put a pretty good markup on something that's not actually too hard to make at home. Making soap at home, making tinctures at home, making herbal balms or health foods or anything like this, pretty low input, pretty high markup and income relative to the input. So literally anything that you're seeing on that shelf, from supplements to hair tonics to toothpastes made with charcoal. You're going to find it on some white nationalist store out there.
And why is it that these kinds of natural or historical, you know, ancestral, as we call it in my tradition, this utilization of herbs and holistic ingredients, why does it appeal to white supremacists? What is their thinking there?
Well, you kind of just hit the hammer on the nail when you said ancestral traditions. They look at these things and they're trying to move back towards an idealized past. They believe that something about the modern world is sick and degenerate and degenerating. And again, that's something that they can find resonance with a lot of people on. There are a lot of people uncomfortable with the modern world and what it means to live in an industrial digital society. But they look back towards the past and say, if we want to escape that, we need to move back towards ancestral traditions, traditional ways of doing things, move back towards the ways of our ancestors. They just have a very racially tribalistic understanding of what that past looked like and what the future should look like.
Right. And this idea, too, I guess, of being strong enough to defeat your enemy. And what always strikes me, I try to have conversations actually about white supremacist movements on the show often because I think we're not talking about it enough. And it's, you know, not just growing here. I mean, we're watching the world shift to the right in governments, you know, Spain, France, et cetera. But what often strikes me is if you didn't have the white supremacist term around it and you hear, you know, that there's something wrong with the world today and we want to live in a better world, et cetera, et cetera. I think a lot of people feel that way. It's just not fueled by hate. And then I think about, you know, in the Black radical tradition, which I'm a part of, right? We talk about that as well. Eat right, train, be able to defend yourselves and your family. So there's this thread of similarity across movements that I find fascinating.
Yeah, there is an uncomfortable shared urge, I think, an uncomfortable shared impulse and desire. And it's a very human thing. It's just, what mental conception do you have of the world and what the world should look like and what is wrong with the world? And for people who feel like they or their communities have in some way lost social power, which, you know, you do have to give up some degree of cultural hegemony or supremacy in order to make a more diverse and inclusive world. For people who feel like they're losing the power that they think should be rightfully theirs or was once theirs or could be theirs again, they're just going to direct that very human, natural, common impulse towards what most of the rest of us would call hate and dangerous extremism.
This is not the plugging into cult, you know, popular cultural phenomenon is not a new thing for white supremacist movement. Can you talk about the 1970s and the punk movement and what happened in Britain and then spread sort of like wildfire?
Sure. The punk movement is fascinating because the punk movement starts as this critique of, again, modern industrial middle-class society, this critique of an increasingly conservative political consensus. It takes a very just smash the system approach, dirty, fast, loud music, and people in that milieu start to just take anything that is deemed offensive or you can't do that on radio, you can't do that on television, and do it just for the shock value, including starting to wear Nazi insignia on stage because, oh, you're not supposed to do that, and oh, it frightens people. And a lot of these people don't have any racist view when they do this, but you sure do see a lot of 1980s neo-Nazi groups looking at that and saying, oh, I can go to this punk show and wear my swastika out in the open and nobody's going to kick me out? Cool. I can go to this show and start to talk to people. Maybe I can make a neo-Nazi band that will start to play punk shows and I can build a space for myself in this movement. And then all of a sudden you've got skinhead groups. The skinheads started out as an expressly anti-racist movement. But suddenly by the 1980s, mid-late 1980s, you've got skinheads who are expressly into violent racial hatred. It's an amazing transformation, honestly.
And not to mention, like, the punk scene, that's where you get the young people, right? The young people that are angry and trying to express their discontent with society as a whole. I was also fascinated in your article that you talked about granola Nazis and the wellness industry in general having its root in hate-based groups. Can you talk about where wellness ideology, I mean, I think people can probably put the dots together, but you can be more explicit, inside of World War II and the Nazis and Hitler?
Credit where it's due. Granola Nazi is not my own coinage. That came from one of the researchers I spoke to for the piece, Catherine Tibaldi. Her work is fantastic. She's a great writer and really accessible academic research. So highly recommended if you want to dig more into the world of granola Nazis, Kat Tibaldi. Her work is fantastic, and she and a couple of other academics have really drawn this line out to show that these concerns about purity have always been wrapped up, purity of race with purity of body, purity of soil, purity of nation. So all the way back into the mid-20th century, you could find a wing of the Nazi party. Not every Nazi was into this. Some of them thought it was very woo-woo and strange. But a wing of the Nazi party that was really into yoga and really into permaculture and really into traditional agricultural practices, really into Vedic health practices, because of course they believed that they were the Aryans, therefore they were connected to the Aryans of northern India. Ta-da, logic. So, you know, there's this connection where they start to look for traditional, mystical, ancestral approaches, just taking a grab bag of everything they can get because they want to purify the body, the soul, the mind, the nation itself as part of their racial purity goal. And you can even point the lens back further into the late 1800s, probably before, but that's as far back as I know that it goes, to movements that, for instance, looked at immigrants coming into the country, looked at the sedentarization of office-bound middle-class white populations and said, oh, really worried about these darker skin-toned immigrants from Southern Europe, of all places, displacing and becoming stronger than white office-bound communities. So we need to promote health and exercise and fitness so that we don't get out-competed, outbred.
What part of the racism in the wellness industry and its overall racist past, where does that legacy still linger?
All over the place. No, this is, again, not to say that there's something inherently wrong with the wellness industry. It's not to say that there's something inherently wrong with wanting wellness. I think we should all want to pursue wellness in some way, shape, or form in our lives. But it is to say that there are these strains that go back a long, long, long way that echo these ideas of purity, pure community, pure body, pure blood, where when you really start to interrogate them, you say, okay, where did that come from? Am I really comfortable with that? And does that wind up hooking into other frightening ideas? And you see this not just with the far right, but there's a lot of conspiracism.
What do you mean by that?
Conspiracism, well, you know, conspiracism can be a tricky term because you will occasionally find a conspiracy that is true. The cigarette industry, that was a huge, legitimate conspiracy. So you will occasionally find true conspiracies in the world. Conspiracism doesn't mean any secretive plot or hidden agenda. Conspiracism just refers to things that are pretty clearly just some people free associating together based on their own biases or preconceived notions of the world, an idea for what's secretly going on in the world that usually has connections to some deeper ideology, some deeper view, like far-right beliefs or like racism. Think classically of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. A lot of these are based around the idea of there's something shady going on. It must be, because I believe it must be true, it must be Jewish groups. So I'm going to string together a series of ideas, increasingly outlandish, but each connection of thought will make sense to somebody who's already deep in the sauce. that connect everything back to a Jewish group. That's conspiracism.
Okay, that's helpful. Sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, I think I was just finishing the thought that, yeah, there are other strains of conspiracism and extremism in wellness, just because you can hook a lot of ideas on the vague notion of purity. What do you define as pure? And how does that hook into some deeper belief or conspiracy that you might hold?
All right, one more character for our conversation, and that is Jason Cohn, who folks think is a prison security guard. Who is this dude? Though we don't know much about him because he's smart enough to not talk about who he really is to prevent being doxxed.
Yeah, he's been pretty explicit about that. He's a guy who really pioneers the phrase white well-being. He's a podcaster, social media personality, increasingly has a presence enough that if you go to a protest, you'll occasionally see a counter-protester holding up a sign with some Jason Cohn slogan on it. And he has written a few books that are all about the idea that there is some sort of conspiracy to degrade white people in America, and that we have to fight back against it, and we have to fight back against things like depictions of interracial relationships and things like diversity and inclusion programs and anything that would challenge what he sees as his conception of white excellence or white well-being. So he very much promotes this strand of thought where he's not off there running. Well, he does have ventures, quote-unquote charity ventures related to his books and his publications, but he doesn't run a wellness venture, but he very much does amplify and solidify this idea of we don't go out and sling slurs at people. We don't go out and march in the street with hate insignia on us. We are focused on the wellness of our community and our group and our people, and how can you have a problem with that? To be against the well-being of white people is to be anti-white, is to hurt or want to hurt or hate white people, which is just a straw man false paradigm, but it is a very effective one for some people.
And this would be, and I can't remember whose term it is from your article, but secret agent tactics. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's related, a little bit different. Secret agent tactics is a phrase that was actually coined by a white nationalist. And it's this idea of we are not going to broadcast our politics. Instead, we're going to adopt a persona that is public facing and very agreeable and very kind and very in line with everything that would be deemed acceptable. And we're going to use that to live our lives as totally integrated members of society. And then once we find an opening, once we find some sympathy, once we find an inroad, we can start to inject our politics into our conversations with other people and slowly bring other people down the rabbit hole with us.
Marque, what do the experts say? What do they say they're worried about, and what do they say needs to be done about this? What are we watching for?
Well, the worry is mostly rooted in a lack of awareness. The worry is that groups like white wellness groups, but not limited to white wellness groups or entities, fly under the radar so well that they do start to reach audiences who aren't on their guard for telltale signs of white nationalism, who don't know the dog whistles, and who will start to eat it up. So the worry is a lack of awareness, and the worry is a lack of vigilance. And the antidote to that is partially sunlight and education. The more that we know that these things are out there, the more that we can actually flag them when we see them and respond to them meaningfully. There's really not a lot you can do beyond that, because you know, you can't stop somebody from harboring a hateful ideology. There's no legal mechanism in America that could, would, or you know, most people would argue should stop them from holding or expressing a certain view. So the best we can do is to not get blindsided and snookered in by it.
And on that tip, when you first started talking to me, the last question, I'll let you get back to your life. How can people recognize these things? Like, are there signs? I was like, well, shoot, I go on random websites and I buy all kinds of wellness stuff, as do a lot of people. I mean, as opposed to the obvious, like Caucasian abrasion type things. Have these things mainstreamed to a point where they could be on a website that maybe I'm perusing?
Yeah. I won't, again, platform or name specific things, but I did recently see a white nationalist publication that made it onto the Amazon marketplace. And it was there for a little while. And it was one of those ones that used this wellness, well-being language to mask itself, to make itself very presentable. And you could see how it would be up on there without theoretically violating any terms or conditions of uses of the marketplace. So it got to be there and it got to exist on the marketplace for a certain amount of time. I haven't checked to see if it's down. I haven't checked to see if it's out of stock, but it was there. And many other things are too. And it is very hard as a consumer, because living in the world that we do, you cannot do due diligence on every single thing that you buy. Doing due diligence is extremely difficult. And often doing due diligence, how far down the production chain are you going to take that? Being aware of dog whistles is also incredibly hard, because when you are a fringe belief that faces a lot of backlash like this, you are forced to constantly come up with new language. Part of it's, you know, I'm getting older, but part of it is, it's like seeing what the Zoomers and Gen Alpha are saying and going, oh God, I don't know what any of this means. There's new white nationalist speak like every year, every 2 years. So you probably can't stay up and up with all the dog whistles. It's just useful to have in your head at all times, politics. Is there something vaguely political here? Is there something vaguely ideological here? If I'm buying, you know, a pencil in a store, kind of hard for a pencil with no direct seller to make a direct political argument to me. But if there is a strangely named, strangely coded product, personally, we all have computers in our pockets. I do a Google. I just try to do a quick search and see if there's anything on it, and maybe pause, because I don't need that beard tonic right now. I can wait 5 minutes or a few days.
When you said that, I used to get my ex the beer tonics all the time. Anyway, all right, Mark, hey, thank you so much for joining us this morning. You all have been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Today, we've been talking about cleaning up white supremacy with Mark Hay, a freelance journalist based in New York who covers conspiracism and far-right movements, among other topics. His recent article in Al Jazeera is Soap to Supremacy, The Rise of White Wellness. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.